Hey, it's Todd in Washington, D.C. We're at the start of a week with a lot of uncertainty about coronavirus. And to be honest, we're going to need your help as we figure all this out. So I wanted to tell you about something we're making time for in the days and weeks ahead. Public health experts have told us the news is going to get tougher, and a lot of us might feel powerless to make a difference, which can leave you feeling a little despondent, but there are hundreds of thousands of acts of kindness being committed around the country every day, and we'd love your help to help us shine a light on some of the good stuff. What acts of kindness have you seen? You can leave us a message at 855-236-1212. You can email us 1a@wamu.org. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We have a free app as well, 1a Vox Pop, which is an easy way to send us a message. What acts of kindness and consideration have you witnessed in your neighborhood? Prove to us that we're not all about fighting over that last roll of toilet paper. Give us a call, 855-236-1212, and we'll share your stories throughout the days ahead. You can find all our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic at the1a.org. Thanks a lot. Here's the show. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Now, a lot of you have been telling us about how you're responding to COVID-19, including a school bus driver who left us this message.
Hello. My name is Ms. Honey. Yes, that's my name. Ms. Honey Love. I am a school bus driver, and I'm calling in regards to the coronavirus. In addition to washing our hands, utilizing the hand sanitizers, also have your children, as well as yourselves, change your clothes when you get home. We are coughing into our shirts. We are coughing into our elbows. Change your clothes when you get home. Put on something clean. Wash your face. Brush your teeth, things of that nature. And if you're able to keep your kids home when they're sick, please do so. I pray that everyone takes care of themselves, and we shall get through this. This too shall pass. Thank you.
Thank you. That message from Honey Love, we appreciate it. All right, let's get an update on the government's response to COVID-19. Dan Diamond is here. He's a health reporter for Politico. He's hosted the podcast Pulse Check. Dan, good to talk to you again.
Glad to be back, Todd.
So, Dan, the CDC has recommended that the United States ban all gatherings of 50 people or more. There are responses across the country. What's the sense in Washington right now about how far behind the curve we are?
Well, I think it depends who you ask and which part of Washington. The Trump administration has moved more seriously in recent days, but it's still generally been lagging rather than leading. And states, localities have taken more aggressive action in locking down events and banning public gatherings. So that is beginning to change with dramatic efforts like the CDC's guidance on Sunday night. The fear, though, is that the U.S. is still on track to resemble the outbreak in Italy, which has gotten so severe that a major percentage of all deaths in that country on Sunday, I believe about one in every four or five deaths, was because of coronavirus. That's how severe the problem has gotten there, and it will continue to get severe for at least the next number of days. In hope of steering away from that, there will be more lockdown-like events coming around the U.S. and potentially from the federal government, too, trying to prevent us from that worst-case scenario.
So Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a major public health spokesman in front of the country, was on all the Sunday shows on Sunday. He was on Meet the Press on NBC with one big message, which is, if you think this is an overreaction, that means you're doing it right.
Americans should be prepared that they're going to have to hunker down significantly more than we as a country are doing.
So, Dan, Dr. Fauci also said that he would prefer the U.S. pull a two-week national shutdown like Italy, like Spain. One person we're not hearing this message from is the president. What does it mean so far that our national response, at least when it comes to what shuts down, who stays home, has not been very national? We haven't heard this. As you said, a lot of this is being driven by localities and states on their own accord, although we do have a new recommendation from the CDC.
Well, Todd, I think there are two things going on. One is the president, the White House, have generally been running behind the urgency of others on this for weeks. That has changed in the past few days, from the president's Oval Office address last Wednesday night to the Friday event at the White House in the Rose Garden that was intended to also show seriousness with the emergency declaration. But I do think the White House has just taken some time in getting up to where others are on this, and there are myriad reasons for it, one being the White House, whenever it decides to move, faces that much more bureaucracy and resistance because it's the most powerful office in the land, and theoretically, there's a lot of calculation that goes into any move that they do. But I think the second reason that the White House has been behind is the president himself didn't think that this was a big issue initially, and then some of his team didn't think it was a major issue. And we've heard that in some of the public messaging from the president, again, until recently, and now that has shifted.
Dan, the president declared that national emergency. What does that mean on a practical level?
I think about his emergency declaration in terms of policy and also in terms of perception, Todd. The government can now tap many billions more, about $50 billion more in emergency disaster funding. The health department, which I cover closely, went ahead and waived a bunch of regulations. So providers, hospitals across the country can do more things quickly, essentially. There will be fewer inspections. They can rush different processes into production without having to check a lot of boxes. The president also made a move to buy up oil for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, even as gas prices have plunged. He waived interest on student loans. He empowered FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to step in and help with disaster response. So some very practical steps on policy. But at the same time, his event to declare an emergency came with a lot of as we say in Washington, optics. He was up on stage with major CEOs from companies like Walgreens and Target and CVS and Walmart, who said they'd help with drive-through testing of coronavirus patients, which is definitely a good thing, and it helped reassure the stock market, but it wasn't exactly clear on the timeline of when they would begin that testing, especially given the testing shortfalls. And the president also said that Google was launching a tool to help people figure out if they need a coronavirus test, but as multiple news outlets have reported, and Google has said, the president had effectively oversold what the company is actually doing.
So, Dan, you mentioned testing. A lot of people are confused about the state of testing now. What can you tell us about how many tests are being distributed and where they will be available in the coming days?
Well, Todd, I wish I could tell your listeners a straight answer on this, but the problem is the messaging has been all over the map from the White House. We have been running behind on testing for weeks. We do not know in the United States the scope of the coronavirus problem. And as a reporter who covers this, I would urge listeners not to put too much stock in the official numbers that are being reported. I was just talking to a friend, a doctor up in the New York City hospital, who said that there are 20 coronavirus cases at that hospital. That is not being publicly reported because there just hasn't been sufficient testing. The health department is trying to change that. They put together a SWAT team over the weekend whose mission is essentially to get more testing, not just online, but into the hands of hospitals and doctors and wave away even more regulations. But at this point, even though there are a number of tests out there, the ability to connect patients with those tests has just been mired in a myriad of problems.
All right, that's Dan Diamond. He's a health reporter for Politico. He's hosted the podcast Pulse Check. Dan, as always, we appreciate your reporting and your perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and stay safe out there.
You too, Dan. Stay safe. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about how prisons are preparing for a coronavirus outbreak. We hear a lot about social distancing, and it's important. You can't do it on the inside, not if you're an inmate and not if you're a prison guard. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Tax season can be complicated when you run a business. LegalZoom is here to help. LLCs, DBAs, S-Corps, they all have different tax implications. But LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys and tax professionals can provide advice on how to set up your business. Get your business on the right track for 2020. Go to LegalZoom.com today. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Change is hard. Transitions can be even harder. But they're also an opportunity to explore and discover and reimagine things you thought you knew. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. And with all this in mind, we've decided to make my entire first episode about reinvention. Subscribe or listen right now.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. The Centers for Disease Control now recommends Americans avoid all gatherings with 50 persons or more. Well, all across the country, places where people coalesce in groups are getting shut down. But there's one type of institution that won't be shutting down. And for the people on the inside, social distancing is not an option. More than 2.2 million Americans are behind bars right now. They and the prison staff are uniquely vulnerable to coronavirus if it spreads in their facility. There are major concerns about whether our jails and prisons are doing enough to prepare for an outbreak to protect people's family members on the inside, including one of yours.
My father is incarcerated in a prison in Southern California, and I'm extremely worried about his health and safety. He's 77 and obviously has no agency over his schedule, his health, his safety, his nutrition. I did receive a generic email saying that visiting was closed, but that family visits were still happening. There was no mention of any protocol for how they will monitor those families that are allowed in or monitoring staff that are coming in and out. My father was sick a few years ago, and it took a lot for him to get the medical care that he needed. So any sort of outbreak in the prison will be detrimental.
That's a message one of you left us using our app, 1A Vox Pop. We got this from another listener. I talked to my brother today. He's incarcerated in Arkansas. He pointed out that without visitation, his facility is well isolated, but the exception is guards coming and going. They have new protocols in place for sanitation and have been disinfecting the cells more frequently. They're in a facility in a county that has a presumed positive case of coronavirus, so the inmates are concerned about the guards coming in and distributing food and mail and prescriptions. Well, joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri is Lauren Weber. She's the Midwestern correspondent for Kaiser Health News covering America's health system. Lauren, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Port Washington, New York is Dr. Homer Venters. He's the president of the Community-Oriented Correctional Health Services, a nonprofit that connects jails and community health care providers. He's also the former chief medical officer at the New York City Correctional Health Services Organization. Dr. Venters, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Lauren, give me a broad sense of the kinds of measures that correctional facilities, state and federal facilities, are taking so far to prepare for coronavirus.
Absolutely. So what you're seeing is kind of a dysfunctional uptick of precautions being taken. At the federal level, the Bureau of Prisons has entered what they call phase two. So there's about 175,000 prisoners in the Bureau of Prisons. And right now, their visitation rights have been canceled. Their legal consultation has been canceled in order to limit access to the outside world where potential infection could lurk. They've gotten increased phone time, about 200 extra minutes a month. And their transfer between facilities has now been limited. On a state level, you're seeing state by state over the last couple of days cancel all visitation. It changes by the hour, so I'm not sure quite what number it is, but I expect in the next 24 to 48 hours that almost all states will have canceled all visitation rights. Where it gets tricky is when you talk about jails, which are governed by local jurisdictions, their recommendations have varied widely. You have some canceling visitation as early as February 28th. You have others that have not done that at all. And so what you're seeing is kind of a patchwork system of prevention control put into place by the varying levels of our criminal justice system.
Have any states reported an outbreak in a facility so far?
So far, no states have reported an outbreak among inmates. It appears that there may be one or two cases where folks are being quarantined under suspicion. There also is some concern over lawyers and other people that come into contact with inmates, such as correctional officers. There have been a few scares and potentially some confirmed over the last couple of days, but that information is all kind of coming in as tests come more online.
So, Dr. Venters, you're one of the physicians who worries about health on the inside. A lot of the health and safety measures recommended by the CDC, they just don't apply for incarcerated people. It's not possible to distance yourself socially on the inside in a lot of cases. Alcohol-based sanitizers are banned in a lot of facilities. Hand washing is not always readily available in all places. Surfaces might not be regularly disinfected. Can you talk a little bit about what's unique on the inside and the risk facing people in a correctional facility during a time like this?
Sure. I think that for those of us who have worked inside, and certainly for people who have the experience of being incarcerated, one of the things is that these places promote the spread of communicable diseases. It's almost as if they're designed to spread transmissible diseases from one person to another. The way intake pens are designed to hold large numbers of people in closed spaces, the way the facilities are often run with poor access to hand washing, broken sinks, no paper towels, no soap, really filthy conditions in the jails and prisons I've seen generally across the nation. They're environments that keep people in close quarters and make it very possible for germs to spread from one person to another. So outbreaks are very difficult, as we know, we learned during H1N1, very difficult to control. And so while a lot of the efforts that have been implemented to keep the virus out certainly make sense in one respect, they're not bad measures, we have to understand that this virus, if it's in a community, it will be in these places, in these 5,000 jails and prisons and immigration detention centers. And when it gets there, it will spread around like wildfire because of the way we've designed and run these places and because the health services really aren't up to the task of stopping it. And so we really need to think much more about how to identify sick people and get them to the care they need. Because that's where we're going to be very quickly.
Well, a member of the 1A Text Club wrote in, I work in a prison. Right now, the medical staff is monitoring inmates who have flu-like illness. The inmates who self-report have been isolated in special housing. Visiting with their family was canceled this weekend as a precaution. The inmates have also been eating in the dormitory building, they live in only. And we asked you to share what measures your facility is taking to limit the spread of coronavirus if you work in a jail or prison. Here's what another listener shared.
I am a correctional officer in Raleigh, North Carolina at Central Prison. We house minimum custody to death row inmates. We also are the regional medical center for all of the prisons in North Carolina. My concern is not for myself, but for my inmates. And I just want to know how I can help them to receive proper treatment and avoid any kind of interaction with this virus.
Lauren Weber, let's talk a little bit more about staffing. A lot of prisons report being understaffed already. We've already established that staff can pose an infection risk to inmates. They do not have the ability to telework like other professionals. They have to be on site. Talk a little bit about how correctional facilities are thinking through staffing right now. Staffing levels, but also we've started to touch on screening and different methods to try to minimize the chances of staff bringing coronavirus into the facility.
So at the federal level, which is called the Bureau of Prisons, you have them telling staff that when they come into work, they have to be screened for a potential fever, which is a sign of coronavirus. So no staff members that work for the Federal Bureau of Prisons can work with over an 100.4 fever, which is a great, you know, that's a great tactic to keep folks out that could potentially have some sort of form of this virus. The problem is that, you know, some of the staffers have conveyed to me that they're worried once they start, which they have, start screening people like this, folks are not going to be able to show up to work and relieve them from their shifts. The Bureau of Prisons has been chronically understaffed for years. It's been a huge problem. It, you know, many advocates argue that it's led to more violence, less effective care, horrible outcomes, et cetera. And so a lot of these staffers are worried that they're going to essentially end up trapped in the prison working around the clock because the folks that are coming to relieve them may or may not be allowed in.
We got this message from one listener who said, I've been working at a prison in Florida, which is also a medical center. We have a hospital, an infirmary, urgent care, mental health and specialty services for inmates from around the state. I think it's important for people on the outside to understand the level of squalor that exists in normal times here. Infections are constant. The inmates are in charge of cleaning up. There is never enough soap. I've had patients pushing rats off of their wounds at night. Unprepared is the only way I can describe our prison here. Dr. Venter, reading that message, it's hard to imagine that any of the recommendations you have for us today in a place like that would mean much if there's squalor.
I think that's right. It's you know, I start with this baseline assumption that jails and prisons are filthy places that promote the spread of infection. And that's how we've allowed them to be run and developed, because we have systematically cut the health services and the questions of health out of our national model of healthcare. So all the groups you hear talking every day on the TV, the CDC, your State Department of Health, the Joint Commission looking at hospitals, those are institutions that promote quality for people outside jails and prisons, but they're essentially AWOL when it comes to the welfare and health services for people who are incarcerated. So I particularly have concerns about all of these places that are called prison hospitals or jail infirmaries, that, you know, based on what I've seen around the country in these places, they do not operate with any of the same lens of infection control or quality assurance that you would expect that we think of when you hear the word infirmary or hospital. And so that is why I am terribly worried that we will have high rates of preventable death when coronavirus goes from the community setting into jails and prisons. And that's why we have to have a primary focus on ensuring that we know who the high-risk patients are and that they get to hospitals outside of these places when they get, when they need it.
Lauren, prison staff, of course, have kids just like everybody else. Those kids are home from school. Prison staff, of course, can bring virus to work. And you've talked about screening methods. Are there any special considerations that you know about for prison staff who have to work long hours? It's probably all hands at this time while the kids are at home.
Not that I know of at this point. I mean, I think that's the same conversation you're seeing surround healthcare workers today. You know, will there be any sort of stand up of school facilities for their children to enable them to perform their civic duty in providing health and providing guarding services, so on and so forth? That's currently part of the national conversation right now.
Katie emailed this. My big brother is in prison in Florida where all visitation has been canceled. We have emailing capabilities. The company JPay that facilitates the email system has given extra stamps to everyone with an account to allow video visitation free of charge. There's some adaptation at that prison in Florida, giving people FaceTime credits or Skype credits while they can't visit in person. We're talking about how prisons are preparing for coronavirus with Lauren Weber, the Midwestern correspondent for Kaiser Health News, covering America's health systems, and Dr. Homer Venters, the former chief medical officer at New York City Correctional Health Services. Coming up, we're going to add another voice to this conversation. We'll hear from more of you, including from two inmates who left us messages about how their facilities are responding to COVID-19. Stick with us. Much more from you and from us. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This week on NPR's Invisibilia, we take you to a summer program for teenagers with sleepovers, marshmallows, and racial confrontation.
I want you to all line up by skin tone, lightest to darkest.
That's up next on NPR's Invisibilia.
Back now to our conversation about how prisons are preparing for COVID-19 with Lauren Weber, the Midwestern correspondent for Kaiser Health News, covering America's health systems. Dr. Homer Venters is the former chief medical officer at New York City Correctional Health Services. And let's add another voice to this conversation now. Joining us from Washington is Amy Fettig. She's the deputy director for the ACLU's National Prison Project. That's an initiative to keep correctional facilities in compliance with the Constitution and the law. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, we heard from a lot of people connected to correctional facilities, including two people who are currently inmates at state prisons. Here's a mashup of what they had to say to us.
Hello, I'm calling from Northeastern North Carolina. I'm not a correction officer. I'm actually an inmate.
I'm calling on behalf of the state of Georgia. The Georgia Department of Corrections has issued an official press statement to us prisoners, but other than recommending general hand sanitization and cleanliness and some rhetoric from the warden, not a whole lot's being done.
From what the officers have told me, they're using no precautions at this time. They're not checking the temperatures of the officers. They don't have any hand sanitizer in stock here.
And there's not enough chemicals and ability to actually make a difference. It's quite troublesome, actually.
All this is very troubling because if the virus gets into the prison system, it's going to run rampant. It's inevitable. So hopefully they can take some sort of precaution before it gets too late.
A quick note, we reached out to the Georgia Department of Corrections and the North Carolina Department of Public Safety for comment on how they're preventing the spread of coronavirus in their facilities. North Carolina referred us to a press release on their website. We did not hear back from Georgia. But Amy, how would you respond to what we just heard? One inmate in North Carolina says no precautions being taken in his facility. An inmate in Georgia saying not enough cleaning supplies, doesn't feel like it's being taken seriously in his facility either. What did you hear?
Unfortunately, I'm not surprised to hear prisoners say exactly that, because that's our experience around the country in the facilities that we monitor as well. And unfortunately, as Dr. Venters said earlier in the program, prisons and jails tend to be these institutions that are filthy and squalid and breeding grounds for communicable diseases in the best of times. And now we're facing perhaps the worst of times. So we at the ACLU are deeply concerned about the health and welfare of the people who live in prisons and jails and the people who work in prisons and jails, because we know that they are generally deeply unprepared to deal with basic things like hygiene and sanitation. And quite frankly, their healthcare structures are very, very inadequate in the best of times. And we're also dealing with a population of people who are very vulnerable. Prisons and jails have lots of people with disabilities, a lot of people with chronic health issues, and frankly, a lot of people with a lot of very serious mental health problems. And that is a toxic mixture when you're trying to deal with a health crisis.
Amy, you just got back from touring prisons in Arizona as part of a separate ACLU effort. What did you notice there? What were inmates saying, if you talked to any, about coronavirus, their worries? What were prison staff saying?
People are deeply worried, and rightly so, because they are describing conditions, and we witness conditions where folks don't have enough soap. They ask for cleaning supplies and aren't given cleaning supplies. Because Arizona Department of Corrections knew that the ACLU was coming for over a month, they had cleaned up a lot of the units externally, but when we walked into the housing pods, they were overwhelmingly foul-smelling. And that was because the cells were not cleaned. You had lots of people who were very seriously mentally ill. There was filth all over their cells. There was feces on the walls. People who had, obviously, we were told, hadn't showered in weeks. These were some very mentally ill people, but nothing was being done to actually give them the power to protect themselves, to keep themselves clean. So we're deeply concerned about what's happening in Arizona, and unfortunately, we know it's most likely reflected in too many jails and prisons and immigration detention centers around this country, where folks just don't even have access to basic things like the soap that they need to keep their bodies clean and the cleaning supplies that they need to keep their environments clean.
Dr. Venters, one thing that I've noticed on this show over the last week or two, day after day, we look at another aspect of American society and how it's responding to coronavirus. And this pandemic keeps exposing gaping holes in institutions in our society, whether it's schools, because so many children get their meals at school because they don't have the resources to eat at home. What happens when you close down a school? The employment market, the economy. Now we're talking about prisons and the conditions in many prisons that have been allowed to develop there. You wrote recently in the Hill newspaper about a central hypocrisy that you see in separating prison health care from health care on the outside. I think it qualifies as yet another hole in how we've designed another institution in our society. Take just a minute and tell us your point on that.
Sure. We have developed this appetite for mass incarceration in this country. And as we have grown this practice over decades of really steering people of color, people with behavioral health problems, into jails and prisons, we have also created a set of policies at federal and state and local levels that keep the healthcare in these places completely separate from all the institutions that are managing actually the coronavirus outbreak. So the people that decide what's the appropriate scope and quality and transparency of health care and health outcomes in most places, those people are sheriffs and commissioners of correction who have no health training, no health administration training. And so for decades, those are the people that have decided what's the right medicine for people to get. Should we give this kind of treatment for substance use disorder or another? That approach has led to the creation of these incredibly inadequate, understaffed, and also disconnected health practices so that people who are incarcerated don't get healthcare that's evidence-based. And really critically, as Amy said, you know, when bad health outcomes occur, including death, there's really very little in the way of investigation. People don't look to see if a standard of care was met or not, and often it wasn't. Mm. Or whether or not a practice inside the facility contributed to that death. And so as we are on the precipice of this outbreak reaching inside these jails and prisons, which we know it will, we have these health systems that we've kept apart from all the other evidence-based approaches to quality improvement that we thought was important to build in the rest of our society.
Lauren, 15 Democratic U.S. senators, including Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and others, they're asking the Bureau of Prisons to explain its coronavirus plan. Have they gotten a substantive answer?
As of this past weekend, they had not, but that was also before, you know, the Bureau of Prisons on Friday announced this phase two that I talked about. So they're kind of waiting to see how this continues to play out. You know, what does phase three look like? What are we kind of going to continue to see as the coronavirus ramps up and as testing ramps up and exposes more and more cases around the country? I think what's important to note too, you know, which an expert, Leonard Rubenstein, had pointed out to me, is that when you are sentenced for a crime, you're not sentenced to get something like coronavirus. But the way that, you know, the experts on this panel and the sources that I've talked to have talked through with me is that infectious disease in prisons like this are common, and you're just walking into a tinderbox. So we'll see what happens over the next couple days.
We got this email from a listener who said, I'm a former nurse and former inmate of the Bureau of Prisons. When I was inside, I lived in a single room with 66 other guys sleeping in an open cell of 10 feet by 7 feet. Coronavirus is going to be a huge problem. I think they should consider deploying military medical services to set up tent hospitals in the rec yard. This will enable inmates to receive the care they need, and the facility won't have to send two corrections officers to guard each inmate at the hospital. Dr. Venters, what do you think about that possible solution?
Well, I think that as we heard from Governor Cuomo here in New York yesterday, there's no doubt that we're going to need extra resources to supplement. It's likely that we'll need extra resources to supplement hospital capacity. My concern in building new standalone tent hospitals inside prisons is that we know that these are places that have failed at basic medical services already, and we should not have two standards of care. So when a patient needs to go to the hospital, when they need to be in an intensive care unit, when they need to be on a ventilator with a certified respiratory technician and in a facility that meets Joint Commission standards for infection control, that patient should be in that place, whether regardless of their criminal justice status. And so I think there will be quite a bit of triaging that happens inside these facilities about finding people with symptoms, how to cohort people with symptoms, people, you know, waiting or receiving a test. But when it comes to the most serious patients, seriously ill patients, we have to have the same level of care afforded to them as we do everybody else. Otherwise, this will be a black mark on the public health response of this nation.
All right, Amy Fedek, I want to give you the last word. And we got this email from a listener who said, I'm the head public defender in Maysville, Kentucky. In an effort to reduce the jail population, our prosecutors and I are trying to agree on a list of people to be released on bond or granted probation early. We're going to try to slash our 200-person jail population in half by the end of the week. That's the solution in one jurisdiction. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely what every single jurisdiction in this country should be doing. The fact is that too many people in our prisons and jails really don't need to be there in the first place. And as Lauren mentioned, oftentimes this can be a death sentence just awaiting trial. Many of the people in jail are there because they don't have enough money to pay their $200, $300, $400 bail. So they're actually sitting in these institutions extremely vulnerable because the institutions are not going to be able to handle COVID-19 in an effective way. So why not let them go home? We should be looking at who's in our prisons and jails and who can go home right now so that they can be safer and the rest of the community can be safer as well.
That's Amy Fettig, Deputy Director for ACLU's National Prison Project. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren Weber is the Midwestern correspondent for Kaiser Health News covering America's health system. Lauren, thanks to you.
Appreciate it.
And Dr. Homer Venters is the president of Community-Oriented Correctional Health Services. He's also the former chief medical officer at New York City Correctional Health Services. Dr. Venters, thank you for your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and Paige Osborne and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, you can visit the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.